That's nice. All right. I think we've made the listeners wait long enough. Let's hear this. Get Shen up to 5 chi trick in turn one.
Basically revolves around half his crew beating him up himself.
Howdy, friends. In this episode, we talk about Shen Long with Peter Sidway out of the UK. He walks us through how he uses all the different styles and when he uses them, how to get the most out of Sensei Yu, which 10 Thunder upgrades he likes, even some key out-of-keyword hires. I really like the segment where he talks about how he approaches Turf War and Corrupted Idols, and I think that that'll be valuable to anybody playing Malifaux, not just those playing Shen Long. There's some really nasty tricks he covers using the Wandering River Monks in certain schemes, and a key segment on what schemes you should definitely not pick when you face Shen Long. Enjoy.
Playing a tabletop strategy game allows you to unplug and test your skills against friends. Every week, Third Floor Wars delivers useful strategies, discussions, battle reports, and reviews to tabletop games like Malifaux. If you want to get better at the games you already play, or discover the games other people are playing, you are in the right place. Craig and Ray welcome you to the Third Floor and the Tabletop Talk Broadcast.
Craig here on the Third Floor. Today we're going to do a deep dive into the Ten Thunders Master Shen Long and how his monk keyword crew works in Malifaux 3rd Edition. My guest today is Peter Sidway. Now, we've seen Peter hitting the podium pretty actively, especially now that he's back in playing Malifaux. Where I really enjoy connecting with Peter is on his blog. His blog is the Mid-Table Obscurity blog, and he's been putting up some very interesting articles. And we'll have links to that blog in the show notes. You may want to make sure you check it out. So, Peter, welcome to the Third Floor.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, what have you been playing lately?
Mostly Shen Long, literally.
Has it been? So before we even get into it, Peter, I've been really looking forward to this because I think that there's kind of two boogeymen right now in third edition, and it's Zareda and Shen Long. I think that's where I'm hearing most of the grumblings about. So I think that I am very anxious to learn more about it. Now, have you always been a 10 Thunders player, or is this new for you in third edition?
No, so I was originally 10 Thunders when 2E came out. And then briefly switched to Outcasts, but 10 Thunders always been my sort of true passion.
Gotcha. And other than, do you play all the Masters or pretty much primarily Shen Long?
Currently in M3E, just Shen Long. Trying out Yan Lo as well after one of your great podcasts on him.
Thanks. Yeah. I've got to get my Yan Lo painted because I'm dying to put him on the table.
He looks really strong. I really like the look of him.
Yep, definitely. All right. So what we're going to do, Peter, is I want to really kind of focus on kind of your thoughts on Shen Long, how you build a monk crew, how you, you know, address and get into crew building when relative to the pools and things like that. So to kind of kick us off, can you give me a kind of an overview? Let's pretend one of the listeners has never heard or played or seen Shen Long. What do they need to know about Shen Long out of the gate?
So Shen Long, basically, from a background point of view, he's a sort of a Shaolin monk type character, but he's actually the host of the Dragon Tyrant. So he is one of the hosts of one of the various tyrants at Nokman in Malifaux. From a master point of view, he's kind of a mixed bag, really. He's most infamous for being the beta, but I think he can switch up to doing support and a number of other functions as well. But I think it's his beta sort of side of him that's given everybody the boogeyman view of him.
And we probably should go right into kind of that main mechanic. So can we talk about the chi and the different styles?
Yeah. So the monk sort of keyword generally has the chi ability, which basically gives them a resource every time they activate that they can spend either for a +2 to a duel or certain abilities and certain triggers and things like that actually require you to spend a chi before they can go off. But I think it's the +2 to any flip, basically, that you can spend the chi for, which is a strong part of it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think for me, the biggest part about that is that you get to decide post flip. So it's not like focus where you have to spend the focus and then see what happens. You actually get to flip and then decide whether you're going to spend the chi or not, correct?
Yeah, so it's post flip, but pre-cheat. So you have to, if you want to actually cheat another card in, you have to use your focus before you do the cheat. But the plus two does carry over to the cheated card as well.
Yeah, that's nice.
I find it really useful to sort of deter the opponent. So if you hit a 15 and they hit a 16, you just burn that chi, takes up to one more than them, and they've got to then start flipping and cheating first. Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's the chi sort of side of it. It's, I think the big versatility is it's any flip.
Yeah.
So if it's simple duel, opposed duel, anything like that, it's a plus two. What it obviously doesn't do is change the severity of the hit. So it's still a weak, moderate, or severe, so it can't be used to manipulate that kind of aspect of it. But it's certainly very powerful for basically card manipulation and making your control hand a lot stronger than what it would be normally, as well as the stats of some of the monk keywords.
Yeah, and I think you also can't underestimate the psychological damage that does. When you're flipping tight and you're just seeing that Shenlong player just burning a cheetah, just barely get over the edge and push it over. And I like your point, Peter, about it deterring cheating.
Yeah, I found quite a few times where it sort of you burn your chi first and you don't need to actually cheat because the opponent is so sort of psychologically put off from cheating, knowing that if you're holding a 13, they just simply cannot beat you.
Right.
That some of the times they will just basically allow you to do the move that you've tried to pull off and has to use the cheat to get through it.
And you've saved that 13 if you did have it.
Yeah, exactly. So most of the crew with chi and 13 in hand is pretty much unstoppable.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how is he getting chi, or how are the different monks acquiring the chi?
So the main way of acquiring it is whenever a monk keyword activates, they just gain one chi. So that's fairly straightforward. Again, there are certain triggers and certain abilities which generate more chi. Probably the most sort of well-known of them is that Sensei Yu. If a monk model takes damage within 6 inches of Sensei Yu, they gain a chi once per activation.
Yeah, and that's, so the reliable thing is obviously when they activate, and then there's other things, Sensei Yu and triggers that can get that. Can you kind of give me an idea, how much chi is he walking around with on a given turn usually, Shenlong?
Typically, by the end of the first turn, he's normally got 5 or 6, but that's because that's because there's a very sort of sneaky little trick which you play in the first turn in order to deliberately power up his chi along with other conditions and things that actually will help you later on. Most of the other monks will only normally have 1 or 2. So they don't tend to get that high. But if left alone, obviously they can just slowly accrue it.
Well, everybody listening right now is dying to hear the trick, and I'm going to make them wait. we'll talk about that more in a second. So the chi is obviously a big mechanic, but I think the other big thing is to cover the different styles and how that works. And let's talk about, if you don't mind, Peter, in context of him as well as the aspiring.
Yeah, so basically there's 4 styles, and anyone who's played sort of M2E will be familiar with them, and they are based on the various types of monks that you can also get. So there's Low River Style, Wandering River Style, High River Style, and Fermented River Style. And it's these styles that basically make him that much more flexible. There's a style for healing. There's a style for a much higher blast combat type attacks. There's a style that does sort of pushing around of models and schemes and scheme markers and grab and corpse markers. And then there's the Fermented River Style, which I think is the boogeyman style, which basically is what turns him into the beater that everyone comes to know and fear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the nice thing about when he equips a style, the appropriate monk of that style gets to focus for free. So if he equips Wandering River Style, any Wandering River monks in your crew automatically get a focus from that, which is powerful to begin with. And then also each of the styles has basically got an ability on it and an action on it. And the aspiring students can, for their bonus action, take the action off the style which Shenlong has attached to him, irrespective of range. So it doesn't matter where Shenlong is on the board, they can take the action associated to the style he's currently attached.
Yeah, that's nice. Now, when does he pick his styles? When he activates?
Yeah, so basically at the start of activation, he discards all his styles, or his style singular, And they can equip the style. Now, obviously, you can re-equip the one that you had the previous turn, or you can choose to swap to another one. There is also a trigger on each of the actions that are built onto the cards to allow him to switch styles at the end of that particular action. So he has got some flexibility for swapping during turns.
Yeah, and I think that kind of the big thing that I've noticed, and I'd be curious to know your thoughts, when we talk about the flexibility, I think what's key here is he's not picking the style at the beginning of the turn. It's when he's activating. So I think it allows the Shenlong player really to see the board state in a much better condition, possibly mid or late turn, to know what style to flip to.
Yeah, you're basically looking at which style is required at the specific moment you activate. Does he need to get out of dodge? Does he need to heal himself? Is he embroiled in a big fight and needs to sort of really bring the pain? And you can pick the style which is specific to you, but also not underestimating the power of the students to pick up that style as well. When they start using some of the sort of the attacks that Shenlong can generate off his styles, that can also throw the opponents for a loop.
Yeah, without question. I think that was one of the things that snuck up on me the first time I came across it. So let's talk about him as a beater. So this, I get the feeling that from a style perspective, that's the fermented style.
So High River style is technically another beater one as well. It gives him a sort of dangerous attack with blasts and stuff, but it's the combination of fermented river style of its ability and its attack. So its ability does the sort of the classic drunken kung fu switch, where it switches all negative modifiers to positive and all positive modifiers to negative, which obviously means that on damage flips, it's really powerful because that double negative, that single negative suddenly becomes positive, double positive. And so his attacks will generally be doing moderate to severe damage, and most of them top end at sort of 5 damage. So all of a sudden you've got a master who's consistently probably putting out at least 3, probably 5 damage on every blow he lands.
That's so good.
It's really strong. And that's part of the reason why he gets the sort of the beta reputation. Because obviously flipping the negatives to positives means that things like Serene Countenance means absolutely nothing to him. Manipulative, yep. Absolutely nothing. He actually prefers attacking models with those on them because he'll automatically get that built-in sort of positive on the attack. Hard to wound, he loves it. Again, that makes it really hard for you to get anything beyond a straight flip from the damage. So that drunken kung fu ability is very strong. And then the attack associated on that card is also incredibly mobile due to the amount of movement it allows before you trigger it. So you make your charge action, so in Shenlong's case, 5-inch charge, and then you have to spend a chi to do the falling rave kick. But as a prerequisite of doing the attack, you then get to move another 6 inches.
Oh.
And that really opens up his threat range. So he's capable of like a 22, 23 inch strike using his 2 moves and then this falling rave kick.
Yeah.
But the other obvious thing is that the falling rave kick doesn't say anything about it's not disengaging strikes, it's nothing like that. So if you're engaged with multiple opponents, you can use that movement built into that falling rave kick to move yourself around out of the engagements of all but one of the models and just be engaged with one person when you kick them, or even charge around corners effectively, because again, it's a move, it's not a push. He can really sort of seek out and find the target he wants to attack.
Yeah, that's really tough, I think, for the opponent to be able to compute all those vectors. I mean, I would think to a certain degree when you're playing, and Peter, there's times where you go, I guess I can get to there.
Yeah, and I think that's the sort of the next level stuff you're coming on to later on is just spotting all those opportunities of when you can get to somebody or when you can use it to get out of combat or all the possibilities of sort of that the combination, because it also finishes with more movement as well. So once you finish the attack, if you succeed, you then get to push 1 inch. So again, so once you've even gone in, hit somebody, you can then push out to allow yourself to be unengaged.
And does he have a 1 or 2 inch engagement?
He's got 1 inch. So all his attacks are 1 inch. So yeah, basically, assuming your opponent doesn't have a 2 inch, your opponent model doesn't have a 2 inch engagement range, you can come in, hit them, and then push yourself out so you're unengaged with them, which does play nicely into one of his other attacks as well.
Which one's that?
So he's got a ranged attack, which does have the gun symbol, but it basically ignores hard to kill and demise triggers. So another classic one is he'll come flying across the board, slam into an opponent, do them some damage using either the drunken rave kick. He will then, when he puts his opponent onto maybe sort of 1 or 2 wounds, he pushes out and shoots them with the anti-demise trigger. and just takes out people like Levy, you know, like these people that got Itemized Eternals and stuff without their ability to trigger it.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Now, the other one you mentioned too, Peter, is the High River. You mentioned it had Blast. Is there anything else important on that card?
So it hands out Burning, which is sort of it's basically a small bonus. Not much of the crew actually utilizes the Burning particularly. But yeah, it basically does. It's got a 3 minimum damage, which is why it's sort of the beat star one. Whereas the Drunken Rave Kick has sort of a 1-3-5 damage track, so it's quite varied in what damage you do. The Flaming Dragon Kick has 3-4-5 with a blast on severe.
Yeah.
So it just kind of depends what situation you find yourself in. The High River style also gives you Ruthless. So it's really good against those sort of terrifying models where you can just basically ignore that and come in for your min damage 3 attack.
And to tie into something that you already said, Peter, is it's key is that even with terrifying checks, he could use that chi to bump up his results there too, right?
Yeah, exactly. So if you just miss their target number, you can just burn your chi, take yourself over it. And that's, I think, one of the sort of the lesser realized uses of chi. It's like the simple jewels as well. Shockwave attacks when people sort of throw out movement checks or sort of that kind of stuff. You can use it on that as well to just tip yourself over the balance rather than having to cheat in one of your cards.
Yeah, when there's only 13 values and you're able to adjust things by 2, I mean, that's a big adjustment.
Yeah, I find quite a few times it really is. It stops at a really frustrating thing you have when you've just missed the target number or you've just missed passing a simple duel. And normally thinking, oh, now I've got to burn a card and cheat something in. Whereas in this case, it's like, no, I'll just use the chi, move myself over the target number and move on.
Yeah. Now, he's flying all over the table. He's got two different styles that are allowing him to do damage based off of whatever the particular situation is. What's keeping Shen alive?
So there's a number of things. So fairly straightforward, he's hard to kill. So you're going to take at least that last wound off on its own. He's also got a nice sort of possibly corner case, but ability called Sacred Ink. So if anyone tries to put a condition on him, he can basically burn a chi and ignore it, not take it.
Nice.
The big advantage is you don't get the condition. So a lot of the masters like Jackdaw or people that have an ability to stop you from removing it. So the way the Sacred Ink works, you never get it to begin with.
Right.
So Jack can't keep it pinned on you. That's sort of the other sort of really strong one. And then the other big thing that obviously helps him keep alive is Low River Style. So when you get onto Low River Style, it comes the action built onto that, rather than being attack action, is a heal. And it's a heal for 2-3-4.
That's
which
nice.
Which is obviously really strong, yeah. Especially when you might remember that the aspiring students can pick it up as well.
Right.
So all of a sudden, these 2-stone totems you've got for free are throwing out 2-3-4 heals, needing only a 7 to go off.
God, that's good.
Which obviously becomes a 5 because they could burn a chi to do it.
Yep. And they're getting their chi when they activate.
Yeah. So yeah, like everybody else, they're picking one chi up when they activate. So for their bonus action, they can throw out these heals onto Shenlong. So if you haven't sort of alpha struck him so far forward and the students are nearby and they you flip onto Low River Style, there's a lot of healing that the crew can put out just from those 3 models alone.
That's nice. All right. I think we've made the listeners wait long enough. Let's hear this get Shen up to 5 chi trick in turn 1.
Basically, rolls around half his crew beating him up themselves. So effectively, the aspiring students will start in base contact with Shen Long and they'll activate first. And for both their 2 AP, they'll basically punch him. So their attack action only does 1-1-2 damage. So you're pretty much only going to basically put 4 damage on Shen Long during the course of these 4 AP. Each first damage that he gets inflicted as he activates, Sensei Yu hands out a chi to him. So the first student will give him 2 damage and a chi. Second student will give him 2 damage and a chi. But then the also really nice thing about them is their attack hands out distracted.
Oh, nice.
Normally a downside, obviously, but the moment he flips into Drunken Kung Fu, sort of on the Drunken River style, those negatives and distracted become positives, and all of a sudden you're basically throwing a positive to attack. So typically after the first two activations as a crew, Shenlong will be sitting there on two or three chi, because again, the students have an ability to transfer a chi from one model to another model.
Oh, wow.
So the second student will basically transfer one of the chi that the first student picks up onto Shenlong as well. So two activations into the first turn, Shenlong will generally be sitting on three chi, four distracted, and having lost four wounds. But that sort of really begins to set him up. And then obviously you can use other people to beat on him as well if you need to basically keep increasing his chi and potentially distracted, because a number of the crew do hand out distracted on their attacks.
Yep. What's interesting to me about that is that, you know, there's a lot of masters out there where you kind of have these turn one tricks. McMorning has it, you know, what you just talked about. I think what's interesting about this is a lot of times that those turn one tricks can involve a lot of complicated models and expensive models, whereas here you're really only involving the totems.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously a 9-point model stood nearby to give them that chi, so Sensei Yu. It's not using any of his AP to do it, though, so right. He's still fully there to activate.
Yeah. He's not using any of his actions.
Yeah, exactly. It's just basically being there in their presence. It does tend to use a low River Monk immediately afterwards, obviously, to try and heal up the damage you put onto Shenlong. It's not essential, but I tend to find that the healing from the low River Monk can normally just top him back up to full again before he starts going in for his sort of aggressive combat attacks.
Right. So a question for you, when he switches styles, you said that the monks of that same style get focus, right?
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
Do you find yourself switching styles just for that, or is that just kind of a side benefit?
I think that's very much a side benefit. You really have to pay attention to what Shenlong's situation is, and see what style he needs, or maybe you need the students to have for him to, you know, to go to, especially since, unfortunately, the fermented river monks aren't very strong, so they don't tend to feature in the crew very often.
God, yeah.
It's just basically, it's a nice bonus, and there's probably every certain, you know, once in a blue moon where actually you think, I'm going to deliberately shift into that style because I want those monks to get the bonus, rather than actually because I want Shenlong to be in that style.
Right. No, that makes sense. So, Peter, we got a question from one of our listeners, Paul Butler. He has got a question about chi. I'm going to go ahead and play it.
What do you guys think of how effective chi is as a balancing mechanism for the Shenlong crew?
So what I think Paul is asking there is, do you think chi is limiting enough that it prevents the monk crew from, you know, being too powerful, or do you think there's a balance issue related to chi?
I think everybody but Shenlong, definitely. Like I say, you'll typically only ever see most of the monks wandering around with maybe one or two chi on them. If they've got to sort of three or four, it's probably because they've had a relatively uncontested time on the board. Again, when, you know, if the opponent starts beating up on people, then Sensei Yu will start giving them bonus chi from that point of view. But I tend to find the rest of the monks will only have one or two chi, which they'll burn quite frequently. So it's reasonably sort of fair from their point of view. Shenlong is the one who tends to get a lot of chi, but also then he's a master, so it's like,
right?
How much more benefit should he get from that?
Yep.
So yeah, I think it's a powerful keyword. I don't think it's the most powerful keyword. I think some of the other masters have sort of more powerful abilities on all of their cards, but I think it's probably certainly up there in the sort of the top tier of keyword abilities.
Well, and you know, basically having listened to what you've been saying, you know, there's things that are very unique about Shenlong. And, you know, I've got to tell you, as a Rezzer player who, you know, everything has hard to wound, he's a nightmare, an absolute nightmare for me. But, you know, and, you know, like Molly, I'd hate to see Shenlong into Molly. I've never done that. But, you know, it sounds like those niche situations where those just really bad matchups can kind of generate that the crying that we've been hearing.
Yeah, I think anyone with a demise trigger, they don't like playing. I mean, they don't like playing into 10 Thunders the best of times. But yep. Shenlong, because he's got that gun attack with an anti-demise trigger, and then again, because if he's in the drunken kung fu style, he'll be flipping all his negatives into positives, and he'll be probably landing the three or even the four blast damage that gun attack does. It's so easy for him to basically, you know, take out models that rely on their demise trigger as their sort of counter masters, like you say, the amount of damage he puts down, especially on the hard to kill people, that's what sort of gets him this reputation of being this alpha strike beater.
Yep. Yeah, and that mobility is nasty, man. And I think that especially if you don't know what's coming, that could be quite an ice bath.
Yeah, I think it's certainly one of the things I will always tell an opponent if they've never played Shenlong. It's one of the sort of things I will say, you let them know what kind of threat range he's got, because you don't really want to get someone to gotcha moment when Shenlong comes hurtling across the board 22 inches and punches their master in the face.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that I think that gives us kind of a good idea, Peter, of what Shenlong does, what his role is. What we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break. When we get back from the break, I want to talk a little bit more about the rest of the monks and kind of talk about your core crew. So we'll be right back. All right, so we've got nice damage output. We've got some really hard counters coming from Sensei Yu. I think that that's only part of the picture, though. So let's talk a little bit more about the monk crew. And before we dive into your core crew, Peter, we've got some interesting questions from the audience that are related to kind of crew building. This first one is from one of our listeners, Brian.
Hi, folks. Shenlong and the monks seem like a really flexible and versatile crew. The one thing they seem to be missing is a hard-hitting beater. If you were going to take this crew into something like Reckoning, would you go out of keyword for additional damage? If so, who would you look at? And if not, who's your main beater inside the monastery? Thanks. I enjoy the show.
So, obviously, we've got Shenlong as a beater when it needs be. But is there anything else that's putting out damage?
I think it depends on the sort of level of damage you want. So, outside of Reckoning, where you want some damage, but maybe not a sort of a hardcore damage, then the High River Monks and also Thunder Archers, which are both sort of keyword, they're sort of like a medium level of beta. But for something specific like Reckoning, then I do tend to go out keyword to pick up sort of the classic beaters from the Ten Thunders. So you're talking Shadow Emissary, in my case, Shadow Emissary and Yasunori are the two I generally bring in to sort of cover the really sort of hardcore beta aspect that complements Shenlong in a Reckoning crew.
Yeah, from a versatile model standpoint, you have no shortage of beaters in Ten Thunders.
We do have a fair few, yeah. So the Last Swordsman as well kind of fits into that sort of mid-range beater, but it's just beginning to encroach into what I consider to be like a Reckoning sort of level of beater. But the Emissary and Yasunori are two really strong, versatile models. And if you want to go to the extreme, you can start going into the other keywords and start picking out some of the henchmen and stuff that the other crews have. Why pay the extra tax when you've got such good, strong beaters in versatile?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to ask if you've ever gone out of keyword, but I think it would be hard. You'd be hard pressed to pay that tax with such good, versatile beaters.
For beaters, yeah, I go out of keyword in other areas, but for the beaters, it's basically Shenlong and a couple, one or two of the versatile models, depending on how much damage I need to throw out based on the strats and schemes.
Now, do you find yourself hiring either of them in something other than Reckoning? Do you feel like he's even in other scenarios that you need that extra damage output?
I do tend to hire at least one of them, just because I found that if you only got one sort of threat vector, your opponent, most opponents' crews I find have two sort of beaters. Yeah. And so I find that you need to sort of reciprocate that with two yourself. So I do tend to hire Yasunori on a fairly regular basis. But if the pool is particularly very heavy scheming and that kind of stuff, then I could just basically go for these sort of the mid-range beaters and bring in Thunder Archers or the High River Monks, because they have got quite a good damage output, but maybe not quite on the level of Yasunori or the Emissary.
Right. No, that makes a ton of sense. And you're right, Peter. I've noticed that I have been trying to have two damage vectors in my crews for the exact reason I think you hinted at, is without that, then I would imagine you're expecting too much focus on Shenlong.
Yeah, they will basically target him with as much aggro as they can, unless you've got a second vector which you can bring in either to go off into a flank and start harassing some of their scheme runners or stuff while Shenlong plows into the crew, or vice versa. I think those two vectors just give you that little bit of versatility. And effectively that sort of divide and conquer mentality where you can portion up their crew and say one beat is going into one section and one beat goes into the other section.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So, Peter, we got another question. This one is from another listener, Chris Miller, and it's related to good old Sensei Yu. So let's hear what Chris has to say.
Hello, this is Chris from Rock Hill, South Carolina. My question for you is, how do you feel about Sensei Yu in a monk crew? In second edition, his utility made him an auto-include for me, and now I find that I'm adding him immediately to every list I write. But looking back at the games I've played, he never really accomplished anything for me. Do you still think he's an auto-include? And when you do bring him, what role are you looking for him to fill? Thank you.
Now, we've already talked about what you're doing with him turn one to really build up that chi. But are you finding yourself in the same position Chris is, where you might have a little bit of hiring regret at the end of a game?
Generally speaking, not. I mean, obviously, like we said, that first turn shenanigan where we're sort of pumping the chi and the distracted onto Sensei Yu, sorry, onto Shenlong. Sensei Yu isn't actively taking a part in, so he's not spending any of his actions to do it. And I do find that he's got some really useful abilities and actions on himself as well. So the really obvious one is his bonus action, which allows him to take the chi off one particular monk and give them fast.
Oh, that's nice.
So you're talking fast thunder archers, or you're talking fast high river monks, or potentially even low river monks. You know, just that ability to drop their chi down by one and give them fast is really powerful. He's obviously lost the ability that he had in M2E to pick up the styles that Shenlong casts off, which I think is what he's most famous for and why he was an auto-include in M2E. But he still has sort of a wind blast attack, so he can still push models around. You know, he's got this a simple lesson it's called, it gives models fast. And I also find he's got a really nice built-in trigger on his attack, which lets him basically draw two cards and then discard a card. So he's got that card cycling and card draw mechanic as well for you.
How much does he cost?
He is 9. So he is, it's reasonably priced. It's not the most expensive henchman, but I think, yeah, for that first turn, he's an absolute necessity for that first turn to make sure you ramp up the chi on Shenlong. And then I do find that he does bring versatility as well, just by his sort of the auras. So as well as that aura that gives him, allows you to once per activation gain a chi if you take damage, he's also got another aura which allows you to take the concentrate action. You're allowed to discard a card and then take a concentrate action as a bonus action.
Nice.
Especially since one of the aspects of the chi mechanic is when you take the concentrate action, you can either choose to gain focus or you can choose to gain chi. So it's another vector again where if he's nearby and the models have, you've got a low card in hand, you'll just discard it. One of the models will concentrate and just increase their chi pool again.
I got to tell you, Peter, what's overwhelming, just what we've covered so far, is how flexible and how many options you have with this crew. I mean, it seems like everything you talk about, you say you can do this or you can do that or you can do this. And it's situational. You have full agency on your side to decide this is would be better for the situation or not for the situation. Not only with Shenlong, but everything you just talked about with Sensei Yu. It's impressive.
And I think that's also, that's the dynamic and sort of versatility once you started the game. The sheer array of sort of the monks you can pick from. They're very good at counterpicking their masters. So the moment the opponent declares that master information to you, there are certain, you know, the Thunder Archers, the Charm Warders, the Lotus Eaters, they all have versatility in different aspects of masters. And you can really start counterpicking against, you know, demise triggers or defensive triggers or people who put out destructible terrain.
Yep.
And then also the scheme pool as well. You know, if it's a heavy scheme marker one, it will help you craft the sort of the crew around Shenlong, primarily based on the strat schemes and opponent.
So I'm getting the feeling then, Peter, that the core crew for Shenlong for you is not as many stones as it might be for another master.
No, it literally is. Shenlong, obviously, two students, Sensei Yu, and the Low River Monk. That's probably the only, the sort of the auto-include sort of core that comes into every single game. Everything else is then determined by strat schemes and the opponent's master.
Gotcha. Well, so can you give me some kind of some top level hard counters? I mean, obviously the demise. You've got Levy, you've got McCabe, who else are you bringing anti-demise into?
So Levy's the really obvious one. We've only sort of, I think he's only got sort of 7 or 8 wounds, and that demise trigger, if you take care of that demise trigger, it really does hamper him. And again, because Shenlong's got that anti-demise attack on his ranged, he can quite easily kill Levy just by using that alone. But if you think you're going to face a really high sort of demise crew, then yeah, you bring in charm warders as well. That gives you another vector sort of to shut down that that trigger, and they obviously have it on an aura, so they don't actually need to be directly involved in the fight. They can just be standing nearby. So the main ones, obviously, Levy's the really big one. Yanlo, Yanlo himself does have a demise trigger, but obviously his crew quite heavily draws on those demise triggers.
Yep.
Lucas McCabe, obviously, for the episode he's recently done. There's no getting off his horse for him. If you've got a charm order stood nearby, he just dies. And you do have like Hamlin as well. So again, you shut off his ability to use his stolen to keep himself alive when you take him down to 0 wounds. So there are a number of masters that do have that. And then there's obviously the extension of the crews. And if you know that there's like the bad jujus of the world and sort of like that, have that demise eternal trigger.
Yep. That makes sense. Now, So that covers kind of the demise. You also mentioned, marker removal, or hinted at it. So things like Karras and Rasputina and stuff. What's the hard counter on them?
So the Lotus Eaters, which is another minion, they've basically got an ability on the front of their card, which at the end of this model's activation, they can push up to 3 inches towards a marker within 3, and then they remove the marker, and they also get to heal from that. Nice. So that's really powerful, because it doesn't say, you can't do it on the strategy markers, annoyingly. You can't take out the cursed idols. But you can basically, even if it's not described as being destructible, just literally says a marker. So Karras's pyre markers, Rasputina's pillars, they can basically, if they get near to one, they'll just push towards it, remove the marker, and it's a nice little bonus. They'll pick up a bit of a heal themselves as well.
So the list of masters that really hate Shenlong is getting longer as we talk, Peter. Can you give me a couple other kind of hard counters that we should watch out for?
So the other one is actually on an upgrade. One of the Ten Thunders upgrades is Masked Agent. And what that basically does is it, again, puts a 6-inch aura out that shuts down defensive triggers.
Oh.
So now all of a sudden Lady J, who is normally quite sort of happy with her sort of counterattack if someone comes near her, will find Shenlong come screaming across the table, start wailing on her, and he's turned off her defensive trigger. There's a whole list of masters that have obviously defensive triggers quite often built into their cards, and a lot of them mostly use them as a means to survive. So Zip won't be placing anywhere.
Colette,
yeah, yep. She's really forced down to it. You're also talking, the sort of Claire Ironsides doesn't get to punch you back. Karras doesn't get to set you on fire. And because it's an aura, obviously Shenlong can come in, start laying the beat down. And if another beater comes in as well, those defensive triggers have been turned off just permanently.
So good.
Yeah, and because obviously an upgrade, you can put it. So I tend to actually, if I have 2 beaters, I tend to put one each. And I know I'm facing like a Zoraida or a Colette or someone who's, especially the masters who really rely on their defensive triggers to keep them alive. Then that's when Yasunori will also pick up that upgrade. And the pair of them will basically just double team whatever they need to, safe from knowledge that they can't be sort of defensive triggered responded to.
Now, is there any other upgrades that you're bringing in? That has a very specific purpose, right? It's is there any other 10 Thunder upgrades that you find useful?
Yeah, so the Masked Agent one actually has another little trick as well. So it's got a charge with me ability. So effectively, when a model with this upgrade on it charges, before they charge, they nominate another model within 3 inches. They make the charge, and as long as they end their charge, engage with the model, they can move that first nominated model into base contact with it.
Nice.
So one of the things I find that's really tricky with is with going with the charm orders. So Yasunori, he's got quite a long range 7-inch charge. So he tends to get the Masked Agent upgrade sometimes. And what will happen is he'll move close to a charm order. He'll then charge, say, Leviticus and drag the charm order with him.
Yep.
So all of a sudden, Leviticus, who's feeling relatively safe because the charm order is 6 inches away from him, and therefore outside of his bubble, suddenly finds the Charm Order stood next to him just before Yasunori starts wailing on him.
What's so hard about that from the opponent's point of view is that, you know, a lot of times we come up with those combos, right? We're like, if I get this and I get that aura near it, and it takes some setup, whereas you're talking about it just happening in one activation.
Yeah, exactly. So the Charm Order is, you know, moved forward, you know, vaguely towards Leviticus, and potentially drawn Leviticus out, because I have certainly found that if you take Charm Orders into these Masters with Demise triggers, they will go after the Charm Order, you know, fairly aggressively because of they want to shut it down.
Yeah.
And like I say, all of a sudden, another big beta. So, you know, it could be Yasunori. It's really powerful on the betas that have flight. So obviously Yasunori and the Shadow Emissary can leap from, you know, behind cover, behind solid walls, and just drag that Charm Order along with them for the Demise trigger.
Oh, it's so good.
It is. I like it.
I bet you do. So, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you find yourself hiring another master into a Shenlong crew?
So, no. And I think a lot of the sort of UK players have said this, that most of the tournaments here aren't allowing it.
Yeah.
So even in sort of friendly games, I don't tend to do it because we don't need the practice because we're not going to face it generally in tournaments. So it tends to be Shenlong on his own.
But I also am starting to get the feeling, though, that he is one of those masters that has such strong synergies within the keyword that it would be hard to spend, you know, 16 stones to have an out-of-keyword master.
Yeah, so in the Reckoning-style crew, when I tend to take the Emissary and the Yasunori, I do sometimes find myself running low on monks.
Yeah,
especially since, you know, since they use abilities and from a Shenlong's abilities specifically say friendly monk. That ability to make people fast, the ability that Shenlong has to basically make another friendly monk either take the concentrate action or take one of their bonus actions for free. Those things always say friendly monks. So if you do sort of end up spending, like say, 16 stones on a master, you've got less monks to trigger it off.
Yep. Yep, that makes sense. And I would imagine the reverse is true that I don't know. I mean, do you think, and again, I know you guys in the UK aren't doing this, but do you think that he's a good hire for another leader?
He could. I mean, yeah, because obviously, I think the problem would be is you wouldn't get the students, you wouldn't get, you know, all that versatility. Drunken, sort of the Drunken River style, the Fermented River style even is strong. Even without the ability to switch distracted into negatives, it obviously means if you've got the serene countenances or the abilities that give you negatives on your attacks, it's useful. But I don't tend to. I think in 10 Suns, it tends to be the likes of McCabe that gets brought in if anybody is going to be
right
dual mastering. The only one I've thought of, I never actually managed to pull it off yet, is against Sarida, when you basically just take four masters.
We've talked about that here in North Carolina. Nobody's done it yet.
The problem is whenever I go to tournaments, they always ban they ban Duel Master. So the idea of dropping Shenlong and McCabe, Asami and Masaki onto somebody, I just found that'd be hilarious to watch them realize that there's just nobody that they can obey.
Right. No, we've talked about. I'm gonna one of these days. I just got to get one of the guys to try it out because I want to see it happen. I've seen three masters. We have a guild player here locally that'll do three masters, but I've never seen four.
Yeah, and I think guild have probably got the best spread of masters to do that because obviously, you know, they've got the puncher and they've got the shooter and then they can have a support master as well. Whereas I think certainly the 10 Thunders tends to be a lot more keyword specific, and therefore, other than say McCabe Asami as a combination I've seen a couple of times, I think they tend to stick to their own type.
Yeah, no, I agree. Now, we talked about Yasunori, we talked about the Emissary. Is there any other versatile models that are making it into a good number of your crews?
So versatile, the only one I've sometimes take is Lone Swordsman. Again, just because if I need a second attack vector, but I don't think it needs to be a sort of a real heavy hitter, the Lone Swordsman does have a mid-range beta that I have taken into a few crews. But other than that, it tends to just be those two versatile.
And how about out of keyword?
So the only out of keyword I do hire, and I do hire it a lot, is the Huckster. And I think it's just because it's just such a strong scheme runner. It can teleport around the board fairly easily. And another trick, which I don't think any of your two guests mentioned on the podcast when you were covering them, is you give it the trained ninja, and it gains from the shadows. So on turn one, it's already deployed, especially on the likes of corner and flank, it's already deployed in the enemy's deployment zone, tucked right into the corner. It can't take any interact actions, but that's false claims, not an interact, so it can still throw out scheme markers.
Right. God, that's dirty.
Yeah, I've had games before where literally he'll set up the likes of Search the Ruins or those kind of things. By the end of turn one or two, he's already thrown out the scheme markers he needs and can potentially have a retreat back. Or you've got Shen Long, who's got the speed to basically come and support him. So if you do think that they are sending a beta towards him,
right,
Shen Long comes screaming in, and at which point a lot of people change their mind as to whether or not that's a priority anymore.
Yep. No, that's good. It's funny. I would not have thought about that, but it makes a ton of sense. So how much are Hucksters?
They are, can I remember that? They are 6 in keywords, so 7 to us.
All right. So they end up being 9 with the upgrade?
Yeah. So they are expensive, but
yep.
They can, I mean, like I say, if the scheme pool is very scheme heavy, so if it's got a lot of, certainly if it's got the power ritual in there, If you've got detonated charges, they are just unbelievably strong at doing detonated charges. That teleport and place 2 scheme markers, and you've basically caught a model completely napping.
Yeah.
But search the ruins, ley line, they are just, if you've got 2 or 3 of those schemes in there, one Huckster can single-handedly do it and probably have it done, score the first point and have it set up for the final turn by the end of turn 3 just on their own.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. I mean, if they're scoring you 2 points, that's worth 9, right?
Yeah. And when they score you 4, it's even better.
Yep. No, I agree. So I think that kind of gives us, Peter, a good idea of, how you're building that crew. We got it. We kind of talked about how you're building crews based off of what's declared on the other side. What I want to do is take another quick break. And when we get back from this break, I want to talk about how you're building crews based off of what you're seeing in the pool. We'll be right back. Howdy friends, Craig here. With 3rd edition Malifaux released, it's time for you to get a new mat with new deployment zones. We've tried every mat in the business, and nobody has better quality and selection than Mats by Mars. They're waterproof and they roll and unroll easily, and they're even wet erase Marco compatible. They offer over 35 designs and let you add M3E overlays for making deployment and positioning a breeze. Check them out at matsbymars.com. They are offering a sweet discount for our listeners. After you found the perfect mat, use the promo code 3rdfloor to get 10% off your entire order. If you really want to support us, in the notes of your order, request that our logo be put in the corner of your mat. It's the only way to make the best mat in the business even cooler. Again, that's Mat by Mars. Use the promo code 3rdfloor to get a 10% discount. Details are in the show notes. Okay, so we've got 4 different strategies, Peter. And what I'm finding with a lot of people that I'm doing these deep dives with is the keyword that they're talking about has really one strategy that it really shines in. So for Shenlong, is there one strategy that makes you immediately think Shenlong?
I think ironically, I don't think there is. I mean, he's stronger at certain ones and he's a little bit weaker at the other ones. But I think that versatility of the crew he can hire means he can do a reasonably good job of all 4 of them. The Wandering River Monks are obscenely fast, and so they can, the plant explosives and the corrupted idols, they can really shoot out from their deployment zones quickly. Reckoning, obviously, he's an awesome beta. You need to bring in some other betas, but I think he can do all 4 of them basically.
Well, let's talk about Reckoning for a second. How fragile are these monks? I mean, are they a liability in Reckoning?
They can be a little bit. So they do obviously have their chi that they can use defensively. So most of them are a sort of a willpower defense 5. But obviously for like 1 or maybe 2 attacks, you can jack them up to a 7 or even an 8 because of that chi. But that's why when I tend to do Reckoning crews, you bring in 2 of those versatile beaters, just lowering the number of monks a little bit and trying to keep them a little bit protected, because certainly the sort of more schemey monks, so the Lotus Eaters, the Low River Monks, and the Wandering River Monks, they are quite easy to take out. Mm-hmm. They've only got sort of 4 or 5 wounds. So I think if you are having to hire them because of what's in the scheme pool, you've really got to pay attention to them and make sure they don't get taken out.
Yeah, and they're going to be the low-hanging fruit for that first or second point in Reckoning on your opponent's side. So I think that would take some serious positioning expertise on yours.
Yeah, you certainly don't want to overcommit with them, basically. So if you certainly with the Wandering River Monks, they've got like a 20-inch range in total on their first turn. So if you shoot one of those forward, you'll just lose it.
So I imagine, Peter, that really takes some advanced thought on your part, right, to be able to position those threats and get those vectors right so that those, as juicy as those monks might look in a Reckoning crew, you're going to make them really deter that.
Yeah, you're basically relying on the fact that your opponent thinks, well, if I send one of my beasts in, yeah, I'll score the Reckoning point because I've killed a Wandering River Monk, but then Shenlong will come plowing along and kill whatever he's just sent into that crew. So you're kind of doing that fear of trade-off. Do they really want to lose one of their beaters for you losing one of your Wandering River Monks?
Yeah, that's a trade you'd make all day, right?
Oh, I'd love it, yeah. I'd happily take off Rogue Necromancies and the likes of that, and if all I lose is a Low River Monk or a Wandering River Monk.
Yeah, I can see that. So how about something like Corrupted Idols? What are some tech pieces you're bringing into that strat?
So I think with the Corrupted Idols, you're obviously using the Wandering River Monks potentially to get out there. Because of it, especially on the sort of the corner style deployments where the idols can appear so far away from your deployment zone, the Wandering River Monks really do have the speed to get there in the first turn. But the other advantage you've got is because of the Low River Monk, because of the sort of the Wandering River style, you've got the healing so that when they push the idols 2 or 3 inches away, if needs be, they've got that ability to heal themselves back up again. The Lotus Eaters as well, so with their built-in heal, when they push to markers, is another one that can do that push and then heal up from somewhere else.
Yeah, that's helpful. Now, when you're playing Corrupted Idols, do you find yourself kind of spreading out and trying to cover all the bases, or do you tend to focus on one side or the other and then maybe control where the idols get dropped?
I tend to go for the sort of aggressive control of initiative. I'll kick a side, I'll send most of my crew down that side, and then just aggressively try and keep the idols appearing in that side. The problem I found is it can sort of be an all or nothing kind of scenario. So if you start losing control of the initiative because you're having to cheat first and they simply cheat higher, you can end up finding that the idols are appearing in the opposite side of the board, and if all your sort of concentrated firepower is in one side, you end up losing it. But that's what I tend to do. I tend to go for the, especially on the corner style ones, I tend to go for the, I'm going to focus on one corner and try and make everything drop either in that corner, just off that corner, or possibly in the center.
Right.
I think on standard, you can play it a little bit more sort of open and flexible because it's such a narrow line that they're appearing on. But the diagonal ones, I think, if you try and cover both corners, you'll end up losing a weaker corner to the opposition crew anyway.
So for Turf War, Peter, are you focusing more on resiliency or speed?
So I think on Turf War, it's a combination of, from the actual sort of scheme point of view, so strategy point of view, Shenlong and another beta trying to get into their outside of the board and really put the pressure on them on their side of the board. So the slightly weaker monks are hanging back on their own side, potentially near to the Turf Marks in case they need to reflip them, but trying to stay out of trouble. And you're really trying to put the pressure on them. So as quickly as possible, you're flipping their markers back to neutral again by killing, again, potentially some of their weaker models or, in the case of Shenlong, pretty much anybody he wants to on their half of the board. So it tends to be the speed of the beaters and the sort of slightly slower support guys can hang back a little bit.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, we're not going to go through all the schemes, but I would love to know, is there certain schemes that you just love to see when you know you're bringing Shenlong?
So depending on what the masters have declared, assassinate, because Shenlong is, I've found Shenlong is quite capable of killing, a large number of the masters in potentially one round of combat if he gets all three activations onto that model. There are a couple of masters or a couple of key sort of defensive technologies he can't get past, but if you've taken the likes of Colette, if you've taken the likes of Zoraida, Lady J, Leviticus, and you've taken one of those into an assassinate game, I will take assassinate.
Yep.
And I also won't be afraid to basically go, I'm only going to score 1 point from it because I am going to beat down your master on turn two and not worry about that. So assassinate, if assuming they haven't got one of the sort of the few sort of counter technologies that does sort of defeat Shenlong's attacks, I'll take that all the time. And then a lot of the scheme marker ones, so the Search the Ruins, the Power Rituals, and those kind of ones, combination, obviously, of the hucksters, which is not a keyword one, but the charm, the wandering river monks are really strong. There's also a really little devious trick on wandering river style. So, especially on something like the ley lines one, so if you think your opponent's running it as well, so the wandering river style attack has sort of that sort of classic sort of push mechanic. But as well as pushing the model up to 6 inches, you can pick up up to three strategy, sorry, scheme, corps, or scrap markers.
Oh.
You push the model, and then you put them back down again. Now, what's really nasty about that is the rules state that when you place a marker, the marker is friendly to you. So yep. you can pick up your enemy scheme markers, push them, and drop them, and they become your scheme markers. So if your opponent has loaded up all his scheme markers on the center line for ley lines, you can literally walk one of your own models in between two of them, push your own model, so he relents, so there's no duel required, pick up those two scheme markers and flip them to themselves and put them back down again.
And there's no contested flip in that entire process.
Yeah, if you're pushing one of your own models, no contested flip. If there's not, if needs be, you have to obviously go and use potentially the model, just drop the marker.
Yeah.
But again, it's a stat 6. The chi can make it a stat 8. If you're holding a 12 or 13 in hands, nothing they can do. They'll lose some of their markers. Dig their graves as well. The second point from dig their graves, it's quite funny watching your opponent, very carefully put all these ski markers next to corpse and scraps for you to basically come along, blow them, blow them, and just simply flip them over to being your markers instead.
Yeah. Oh boy. That's pretty grim, but I think that's good for people to know when they're facing Shenlong, right? That these are some schemes that he does really well and he counters really well, and you should think accordingly.
Yeah, I think basically the scheme market based schemes are quite nasty ones to take into Shenlong, because not only have you got Shenlong doing that, but you've got Thunder Archers. And one of their abilities can basically lift up a scheme marker from potentially 20 inches away.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if you're dropping, if you've got the likes of Breakthrough, especially I find quite often that when people lay out terrain, especially for tournaments, they tend to make the sort of standard deployment area at the back of the board quite light on the terrain, and they tend to focus the terrain in the middle where they think all the action's going to take place. And what that means is that the deployment zones are fairly open.
Yep.
At which point, like a scheme like Breakthrough is really hard to accomplish, because all it'll take is for a Thunder Archer to be stood, 17, 18 inches away. And when you start dropping markers in their deployment zone, the Thunder Archer will just start shooting them off.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think any scheme-based markers into Shenlong and the monks, you've got to be confident that you can have a deal with those people that can remove them. Because, again, the Lotus Eaters can do the same. There's a lot of means in the crew to lift up scheme markers. And then with Shenlong blowing him around as well, it's a dangerous tactic to do with.
Yeah, definitely. And again, now we extend that theme of flexibility. It sounds to me like, once you know that pool, and once you've, know the opposing player, you've got a lot of tools to pull from, both to accomplish and to counter.
Yeah. And I think I say that's why it's definitely the kind of crew you could not build a all-comers list and say, I'm going to take this into every pool, because you do find that pools are pools, scheme pools, strategies, they all start driving your crew, what your opponent's master is, the keyword that they've associated. So although the master might not have a demise trigger, is the crew famous for taking demise triggers? They all sort of basically help you build the pool and the scheme and crew that's going to help you achieve it.
That's very strong. All right, Peter, what we're going to do, we're going to take one more break. And when we get back from this break, I want to talk a little bit about second level play and the part that everybody is excited about, weaknesses and counters. So we'll be right back. Howdy, folks. Craig here. Now, if you love gadgets as much as we do, you're going to love the new Third Floor Wars gadget bundle from Schooner Labs. Branded with the logo of your favorite podcast, it comes with two measuring multi-tools, a compass stepper for those tight and important movements, along with a compact dashboard to track your turn, strat, and scheme scoring, along with your soul stones and pass tokens. It is the perfect bundle for anyone who plays Malifaux or just wants to look cool while doing it. The link is in the show notes. Check them out and help support your favorite gaming podcast. Okay, so now we're at the point where we've decided there's basically only like one scheme that you can pick against Shenlong, and he's going to kill half your crew come turn two or turn three. I usually lead off here with some second level play, but I don't think I can wait any longer, Peter. What is Shenlong afraid of?
So I think I mentioned before, certainly from a master point of view, there's a couple of sort of pieces of technology that will just shut down his ability to kill them. The biggest one is protected. So if you've got one of the, sort of like the likes of Hoffman as well, that way he's got protected from constructs, that really just shut down Shenlong's ability to kill your master. You'll obviously just throw the attacks off to all by nearby people. So that's a key word. Also, the likes of Jackdaw, who can sort of, you know, so one of the big things that Shenlong is doing is because he's got that fermented river style, he's expecting to land sort of 3 to 5 damage on every single blow.
Right.
And when Jackdaw simply takes it down to a one pointer, or you know, if you can do sort of heavy reduction on that kind of stuff, it will slow him down. Now, he does have a trigger on his sort of primary attack that makes the damage irreducible. But again, if he's having to use the rams to do that, he's not got access to the onslaught to keep attacking over and over again.
Yep.
So again, armor one I found hasn't slowed him down too much, but certainly armor two. That will really, you know, armor two on a sort of 12 wound model will pretty much mean he can't take him out in one go. And you can mob him. When he comes screaming in and attacks a model, if he's gone into the center of someone's crew and you just pile into him, that sort of sustained damage, and eventually he'll start running out of chi, so he can't keep burning the chi, and you will slowly beat him down.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I mean, and over a course of, say, 10 games, Peter, how often has he seen turn five for you?
I would say pretty much most of the games he does. The two that I know of, ironically, one of them was versus Paul Butler, when it was a Shenlong mirror match. so that was basically 3 turns of being very cagey until someone Shenlong hit the other person Shenlong.
Right.
And then Jackdaw. So again, you know, you try to go in, try and take out Jackdaw, but he survived the attack, and you know, that many Guilty and the Hanged and Montressor, they always basically just dogpiled onto Shenlong and killed him. But a lot of times he will survive because of that hard to kill, and then the monks coming up and just healing him up really quickly.
Now, here's the thought I had too. I mean, you know, when we're talking theory foe, like we're doing here right now, it seems like, you know, Shenlong at any point can have any one of his different styles, and it's always going to be the style you don't want him to have. Is there a way for the opponent to really kind of force you to pick a style that maybe you wouldn't be ideal, but you have no choice, you need to go that way?
So the one they can force you into is that low river style for the healing. If they've applied the pressure onto Shenlong before he's activated, he needs to swap, not only because he needs to get potentially heal himself once or twice, but because he wants that style on him so that his students can come in and heal him as well.
Right.
So that potentially will slow him. If he is sort of, you know, aggressively trying to attack people, that might slow him down a turn, as he's got to basically recoup all his wounds that you've basically beaten onto him. But other than that, I think it is basically the Shenlong player's choice.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how about should we focus on the crew then? I just let Shen be Shen and then try to get rid of everything that's around him?
So that's probably the way that I've lost the majority of my games. It's not because they've tried to take out Shenlong, because they've managed to outmaneuver the rest of the crew. Mm-hmm. I think when you play Shenlong, you're pretty much going to have to come to the realization that the first thing he targets, he will kill. You may be able to influence that by, like I say, taking certain defensive technologies or having certain amounts of armor and stuff. But, you know, when he sets his mind on either your master or your main beater or one of your sort of, you know, high cost models, there's a very good chance that he will just kill it. And I think you've basically got to sort of go adapt with that and then try and out scheme him. Shenlong himself cannot win a game.
Right.
He can obviously score assassinate potentially. But then if he's forced to start, you know, putting down scheme markers or, you know, doing outflanks and stuff like that, he starts to struggle a little bit. It's his crew that tend to score. His crew score the points, and he tends to be the disruption. It's basically just, you know, either beating down the enemy crew or just trying to basically ruin their day by not allowing them into certain areas of the board, messing with their scheme markers. He's basically the distraction.
Yeah.
And if you can sort of see past that or accept you're going to lose certain amounts of models to him and take out the Wandering River monks that are doing the scheming, take out the hucksters, you know, take out the models that are actually scoring the points, that's how you can beat him, even if you haven't killed him.
Yeah, what's frustrating, and I don't know if there's anything to be said about it, but, you know, a lot of times when you have kind of that key piece that is just, you know, there's models where you just say you just got to let that model do what it's going to do. Sometimes you can tar pit it, but it sounds to me like it's pretty tough to tar pit Shenlong.
Yeah, because obviously there's a number of, so there's two models. So Sensei Yu and the Wandering River Monks have a push attack, which obviously they can put onto Shenlong. It will do him a small amount of damage, but he can push out from that. And then obviously, again, that fermented river style, it just allows him to, again, if you've tar pitted him with several models, if you've given him an avenue, he will move around to the back of one of the models, hit it, and then push out, and all of a sudden it's disengaged, and off he goes like a shot. So on the likes of plant explosives, stuff like that, you can't pin him down if you need to drop that plant explosives.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. How about, is a ranged crew something you fear? Not necessarily against, you know, taking Shenlong down, but I would imagine, you know, somebody who's got some heavy range threats could be scary territory for the other monks.
Yeah, again, it will limit where the monks can go. So the Wandering River monks, they'll struggle a bit. They've only got 5 wounds. If someone actually, you know, looks at them quite angrily, they will fall over. So it's that kind of thing, like the range crew, depending on how much terrain there is on the board and that kind of stuff, that can cause problems as you sort of shut down where the, you know, scoring models can actually operate safely. Again, there are ways around it. So if you really are worried about it, one of the upgrades that the 10th Thunder have to train ninja, as well as giving, obviously we talked about the from the shadows that it gives the hucksters, it also gives them stealth.
Nice.
So again, a 5-point Wandering River Monk holding a 2-point upgrade starts to get a bit expensive, but if that 7-point model is then stealthed, immune to all this sort of gunfire and can basically, you know, scheme freely, it's potentially worth it.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So the other thing that I've noticed too, doing these deep dives, Peter, is that, you know, you start playing a crew, and you know, you get 5 or 10 games in and you start to see some kind of some hidden gems or things that you didn't notice at first, but you picked up now that you've, you know the crew like the back of your hand. You've hinted at some of that, but, what is some other second level play that people can look forward to when they're playing Shenlong and they start getting really good at it?
I think it's basically, it's that versatility of the styles. It's knowing when to switch to which style. And it's all the little tricks that the styles can do. So that flipping of scheme markers, is, you know, when you learn out when that's really useful. That one, the fermented river styles 1-inch push, it seems like the least sort of offensive part of that card, but the fact that he can come in, you know, laser smack down and then just push out of engagement at the end of the attack. So I think it's because Shenlong and his crew have got such a vast array of tools.
Yeah,
I think it takes you those 10, almost 10, 15 games to actually learn even which tools to bring to begin with. So I think whereas a lot of other crews, you can tend to sort of pick them. Yeah, your first game, you tend to go, I'll have one of everything from the keyword. You can't do that with the monks. There's too many of them. So you're immediately forced to focus on the monks that are going to do the jobs for you. And it's learning that. It's looking at the scheme pool and going, there's a Search of the Ruins in there. I need to take this, this, and this. Either to score it for myself or to counter it. And then that sort of, that interplay with the opposing master, they've declared this particular master, right, I need a Charm Warder, I need a Lotus Eater, I need to put the Master Agent upgrade onto Shenlong. And that's all those kind of little interactions, which each game, each time you face a new master, certainly you'll learn those new tricks that you can do against that master. You'll probably get beaten in the process, but you'll pick up that extra sort of knowledge.
Yeah, and that was one of the big things I was going to bring up too, Peter, and I'm glad you did, is that, you know, with all of this versatility in the right hands, I just can't imagine how good a monk crew is. But with that many choices and that much player agency, there's a lot of, you can with that many choices, you can make a lot of bad choices, right? You can make a lot of mistakes when you have that many options. So it does sound to me like experience is key to get good at it.
Yeah, I've made a lot of bad mistakes. I can say that for a fact. I think you're onto that sort of next level sort of skill stuff with sort of 10 games. I think with Shenlong, you're taking those 10 games even just to learn how to pick your crews, you know, which scenarios need which models and which abilities. The next level stuff starts kicking in when you start noticing the little quirks of, you know, what the styles can do and some of the bonus actions on some of the monks and what Shenlong can do. And it's basically, I think it's a learning exercise until you've sort of encountered each individual master and just seen what that, how your monks interact with that master. It's learning that sort of knowledge.
Well, he sounds good. Unfortunately, the weaknesses and counter section was not as long as I wanted it to be, but I think you gave us something to at least to work with, Peter. But before we go, when we're recording this, we're about, I don't know, a month or two since third edition is released. And for somebody like you who, you know, saw the cycles in 2E, has been playing in 3, I'd be curious to know, let's fast forward. Six, eight, 10 months from now, is there anything that you would expect to see in kind of the next balancing that comes out? And I'm not asking you this because we're talking about Shenlong, so don't even talk about Shenlong getting balanced. But is there other things in the game that you're seeing that you think might need attention 10 months down the line?
So yeah, a couple of things I can think of top of my head. So the really obvious one is Obeys into strategy actions. So I've no issue with obviously Obey as a mechanic. I loved it. I used to play Hamlin in second edition, but mm-hmm. I think that the Obey mechanic, and especially as a rider into the Corrupted Idols and the Plant Explosives, is just so strong. I think I'd like to see possibly the Gaining Grounds coming in that basically says you can't force your opponent to take that interact action. So the rider is still capable of obeying your beaters to beat up your own crew and all that kind of stuff, but she can't make them throw the idols around, and she can't make them plant explosives, or for that matter, any of the other Obey Masters.
And that would be relatively easy to outline, right? You just say, you know, obeys can't be done on any action that's tied to a strategy or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it would be part of Gaining Grounds, basically, which is basically, you know, it's one line saying this action cannot be taken outside of, you know, the model, the controlling player's activations or something along that line, just to sort of shut that down.
Yep.
I'd like to see Gaining Grounds get rid of double masters. I, as well as not using them because the tournament scene here doesn't tend to, I don't like the fact that you can hire two masters.
Mm-hmm.
I like the design space and I like the sort of fluffy aesthetic of it. But I think the moment you go into sort of anything competitive, so many of the masters nowadays are strong and you need to start counter pick against them. To be able to stealth one of those masters past your opponent is nasty. So the obvious example is the rider. You know, you're going into a Neverborn crew. They declare Pandora going into a cursed idols, and then all of a sudden the rider turns up as well.
Yeah,
and you maybe haven't taken those high willpower models. You maybe haven't taken the models that have that technology that allows you to not be controlled, and all of a sudden you find the rider on the other side of the board. Whereas I think the comments that people have made saying everything in Malifaux is broken and therefore effectively nothing is, it plays into that declaring the master. So it's like,
yeah,
it allows you to counterpick, and dual masters basically takes that away from you and says, you know what one of their masters is, but if they're going to do it, they're going to maybe surprise you with a second master who could have technology against, but you've lost your chance now.
Yeah, Peter, I think that I got to tell you, I've heard a lot of arguments for dual masters and a lot of arguments against it. And I think what the argument you just closed on, I think it's the strongest one yet, because in 3, I am finding the power level of the masters is higher than in 2. So I just find the masters to be bigger than they were in 2. And the inability to counterpick and have that stealth master slide in, I think, is a really good argument against dual masters.
Yeah, I think I'd say they're more powerful, but also a lot of them can be not necessarily hard countered, but they can be sort of brought back into check by a careful crew selection.
Yep.
And not having that option because you didn't realize that Zoraida was going to turn up or that Lady J was going to join Perdita or, you know, that kind of stuff, just, I think, just throws out just a little bit too much.
No, I don't disagree at all. I think that's a strong argument. Strong argument. Well, Peter, I enjoyed this. I appreciate you coming on the show. Unfortunately, because of our time difference, you had to stay up pretty late, and I appreciate you doing that. I'm obviously going to link to your blog because if anybody's not reading that, they need to fix that problem. Is there anything else that you wanted to plug?
So I'm guessing that by the time this gets released, it's probably going to be too late for our local tournament. We've got a tournament running at the end of August. Heartfelt. So I'll probably say the UK Nationals. So the 9th of November, we're having the UK Nationals tournament. I believe we hold the record for the most attendees on one of our previous years, and it really is good fun. It's certainly, you know, going to be a big tournament for Malifaux. You get to play against sort of all the names of Malifaux, so the Jamie Varneys, and the Paul Butler will be there as well.
Yeah.
So it's good fun. It's 2 days, and you'll get the games you deserve, basically. So if you're a strong player, you'll find yourself on the top tables facing the other strong players. But equally, there's, you know, quite a lot of sort of casual or sort of more friendly players that come along as well. And, you know, if that's your thing, then, you know, you'll get the games against them. So, yeah, the UK Nationals.
Yeah, I don't know how, but I'm going to get out there next year. I just got to. For me, I think that's the ultimate Malifaux event right now in the world, and I've got to figure out how to get out there and see you guys.
Well, if I've made it over to Adepticon, you can make it over to Nationals.
Well, you know what? Way to guilt me into it, Peter. Thanks.
No problem. I've actually made it over to Adepticon twice, but yeah.
Good for you. Good for you. Peter, I enjoyed it, my friend. Take care of yourself, and we'll have to get you back to talk about another master later.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. Take care.
Be sure to check out our shop on thirdfloorwars.com for the latest gaming apparel and gear. While you're there, check out how the USFO Tour is shaping up. How does your conference compare to the others in the United States? Where do you rank nationally? Get those models built, painted, and on the table so we can see you at the US Masters Invitational in October of 2020. Also, rate and write a review on this podcast for us. It really helps us find people almost as cool as you are. Thanks for listening. Howdy, friend. Craig here. Is this episode making you realize you need to buy some models? Gadzooks Gaming is my favorite online retailer because of their large selection, killer prices, and great customer service. Don't you hate buying an entire crew box when you only need one model? Gadzooks sells crew box models individually and saves you a ton of money. They even have free shipping to the US and Canada if you spend $100 or more. Swing by GadzooksGaming.com and make sure you tell them Craig from the Third Floor sent you. All the details are in the show notes.